Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number anyone may call for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody followed by the number 8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT.
Ain't got no home.
No one of the problems with helping the homeless is that people don't agree on what that means. Some say the homeless need tough love. Some say they need counseling and treatment. Others call for housing first, while still others say we need to focus not on the homeless, but on the conditions that cause homelessness. We'll hear two diverging views on what it means to help the homeless right after this. I'm a lonely
boy. A home is something special to Lynn Collins. That's because she hasn't always had one. 10 years ago, Collins had a stable job at a bank and a live-in boyfriend. When she became pregnant, she decided to become a stay-at-home mom. But several years later, the mother of three lost her boyfriend, then her children, and then her apartment. For 2 years, Collins was homeless. She didn't have a job, and she turned to drugs, unsure of how to get her life back on track.
When I woke up one day, well, I didn't wake up, I came to. There were some children who were in a park, and they were getting ready to have a picnic. And they started shaking me and waking me up. I didn't know how I had gotten there, didn't know where I was. And I think at that point, I knew that I had to do something different.
Collins enrolled in a faith-based recovery program, got a job working at a call center, then another working at Project Home, a homeless support services organization in Philadelphia. She was able to get back custody of her son and two daughters who'd been living with relatives, and they moved into a new apartment.
Well, I remember kissing the carpet, which might seem like a crazy thought to somebody else. But after living on the street and sleeping on the ground, you can find a whole new appreciation for a small thing like being able to turn a key into a door and knowing that at least for a certain period of time that it has your name on it.
This could have been where the story ends. Collins doesn't make enough money to save much. She dreamt of owning her own home and paying a mortgage instead of a rent, but there's no way she could afford a market-rate house without assistance. Project Home, the organization Collins works for, is redeveloping 15 houses in North Philadelphia, a low-income part of the city with a high crime rate. The Collins family will be one of the first to move into a house here. Damien Camille is working on the construction crew. He also happens to live down the street from the abandoned houses he's working on.
These two, probably 8 and 10. The three in the middle, at least 32 years abandoned. They were abandoned before I was born, and when I came up as a little kid, they were always abandoned.
Camille sees housing construction as a way to revitalize the community, even if the houses being built are selling far below market rates.
It had dilapidated between the normal atmosphere of drugs that come into the communities and the urban area, crime coming up. So the actual major transition of coming in here and developing is showing there's economical opportunity for everybody down here. More investors, more people, you know, the whole area changes.
Each of the renovated homes will have 3 to 4 bedrooms, a living room, and a kitchen. And they're designed with energy efficiency in mind to keep utility bills low. They're the sort of homes that Collins and many other Philadelphians would never dream of owning if they weren't heavily subsidized by a combination of government and private dollars. Kevin Hanna is head of the city's housing agency, which acquires abandoned buildings and helps fund affordable housing development. He says the concept of affordable housing is based on the assumption that no one should have to spend more than 40% of their income on housing. Hanna says there are tens of thousands of Philadelphians who could benefit from affordable housing development, while only about 500 to 1,000 affordable units are built each year.
Housing in Philadelphia is probably more affordable than most any other large city anywhere along the eastern seaboard from Boston to Baltimore. That's great. The problem is the incomes of a lot of Philadelphians is well below the average income of people who live and work between Boston and Baltimore. So even though housing prices are lower, it makes it just as, maybe even more difficult for a low-income family to afford a house here, even though housing prices are here, lower here.
The median annual household income in Philadelphia is $30,000, and about 20% of the city's 1.5 million residents lives below the poverty line. The house Lynn Collins will be moving into is heavily subsidized, It'll cost $250,000 to renovate, but she'll be able to buy it for $70,000. As a first-time homeowner, Colin says she also has to learn how to take care of her property.
There are classes where you learn about what it means to have a credit report, why a credit report is so important, what you need to do to maintain a home, because it's not enough to just have one. It's just like a car. You can get a beautiful car if you can't maintain it. What difference does it make? You have to learn about the maintenance and the upkeep and, you know, not take it for granted.
Collins and her three children move into their new home this summer.
I ain't got a home.
This story originally aired on the NPR show Justice Talking and was produced by Brad Linder.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon. We're entering our fourth hour, and we're going to ask a very simple question. What does it mean to help the homeless in the first place? Those numbers to call in if you want to join our conversation are 877-NOBODY-8, 866-LEFT-OUT, or 463-1035. If you're local, I'm in Pass Christian, Mississippi, and we're talking about the poverty, not just the debris, left in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Now, of course, as with any political issue you could ever name, there are differences of opinion about what approach we should take. And we have two very distinguished guests here who will help us to discuss this question of what should we be doing to help the homeless, help the poor. Sitting with me here at our desk in Pass Christian, Mississippi, is Jeremy Rosen, who is the director of the National Policy and Advocacy Council on Homelessness. And on the phone, I have Dennis Culhane, who is a professor, I think, of urban planning. I think your title changed, Dennis, at the University of Pennsylvania. And I want to welcome you both to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dennis, what is your title now? You're a professor. I thought it used to be urban planning. Did it change?
No, I'm a professor of social welfare policy.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for setting me straight on that. Now, Dennis, you have made a kind of, some people might say, radical proposal to dismantle the shelter system altogether and then concentrate the money that we're saving on helping the chronically homeless. Can you tell the people listening about that?
Well, I think that's actually a mischaracterization.
That easily could be, because I'm not an expert on it. So tell people what you proposed.
Yeah, no, I think that one of the things that we've learned over the years as we've, you know, understood this problem better is that there are a substantial proportion of the homeless on a given day. If you're looking at the single adult population,
right,
as many as half on a given day are people who are not getting out of homelessness on their own. They are on the streets, they're living in the shelter system, and it's not an emergency system to them. To them, it is their permanent place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And these programs were never designed to be permanent housing programs. And if you look at their economic structure, they certainly were not financed with that in mind. I mean, on a national basis, it costs about $13,000 to operate one of these shelter beds. And there's, you know, nary a housing market in the country where one of these homeless individuals couldn't get an apartment for substantially less than that. So it has occurred to many people and folks who are, you know, and particularly in places where the public sector pays a large portion of that, that they should be using those dollars to put people into permanent housing, providing them with support services as necessary, but essentially, you know, instead of having people living in shelters, have them in a higher quality of life and inside, you know, permanent housing units. So I think that's the crux of the point around chronic homelessness. The other thing to note there is that a lot of these folks are also expensive users of other programs. They're clogging up emergency rooms. They're going back and forth between shelters and streets and hospitals via EMS services that are very expensive. They're getting arrested all the time and put in jails, and that you know, you accumulate all those costs, and it's far and away better to be investing those public resources into a solution rather than simply trying to maintain people and manage a state of homelessness. And so I think that's the crux of that particular argument. But no one is arguing, I'm certainly not arguing, that the shelter system in total would need to be replaced on that basis.
All right. Well, Dennis, thank you for clarifying that. And you are the expert, of course, on your own thinking. Jeremy here sitting next to me, we're both named Jeremy, so it's a little confusing, but the one who's not me, what Dennis says sounds perfectly reasonable. Why would your approach differ somewhat from Dennis's approach?
Well, I don't think my approach differs in the sense that I, too, believe that everybody should be living in safe, decent, affordable, and permanent housing. I think, unfortunately, though, that some of Dennis's research and his ideas have been taken a little bit farther than Dennis, in his comments here, has taken them in communities across the country. And so what you've seen in a lot of communities is, in fact, a complete disinvestment in the shelter system. So, you know, while we're able to permanently house a certain percentage of the homeless population, given available resources, we also have a lot of people left over who we haven't been able to permanently house. And in some communities, at the same time as they're perhaps providing housing for 10 or 15 or 20% of homeless people, they're closing emergency shelters and really leaving no options for the 75 or 80% of folks who are not getting permanent housing.
Dennis, what would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I don't think that investing in emergency shelter is helping anyone. Even, you know, aside from the fact that these resources that are, and we're talking about existing resources that are being spent on chronically homeless individuals that could be shifted, okay? Aside from those resources, talking about the rest of the homeless population, I don't see how the rest of the homeless population is assisted by investing in shelters, because essentially what that does is locks people in a state of homelessness. I mean, a shelter never solved anyone's homelessness. What solves people's homelessness is getting them back into housing. And as long as we continue to put money into shelters, we're paying people to essentially maintain homelessness. I mean, the unfortunate fact of the matter is we have shelters for the homeless, transitional housing for the homeless. We have food programs for the homeless, care for the homeless, health care for the homeless. What we don't have is anyone who's investing resources in getting homes for the homeless. And that is the problem with a shelter-based strategy. You know, these shelters are 19th century institutions. There's not a homeless person that I've ever met who wants to be in one of these shelters.
Well, I think you'll get no argument about that.
Why we should be investing money, and why anyone would argue that we should invest money in shelters is beyond me, because, you know, we really know that the answer has nothing to do with shelters. Shelters are the problem. And, you know, I think what's great is the Obama administration and the Congress recently passed in the Economic and Recovery and Reinvestment Act a $1.5 billion program, not a nickel of which can go to shelters. It has to be spent on getting people back into housing, helping them pay their rent, and you know, ending homelessness for these individuals and preventing it in the first place.
Okay,
that's
well,
where our resources should be going.
All right. Let Jeremy respond to that. Jeremy?
I'll just say this. Nobody's suggesting that shelters are a long-term solution for anybody, so to even raise that, I think, is a bit of a red herring. What I am, however, saying is if you take a woman and her two kids who flee their house at 3 in the morning because of a domestic violence situation, those folks are not going to show up somewhere and be ushered into a new apartment at 3 in the morning. And we have cities who are cutting emergency shelter capacity for folks like that, leaving them with no place to go, forcing them to stay in unsafe situations. And I think we need to be mindful that it's impossible for us to have a functioning homeless system if we do not have some emergency shelter capacity to take care of folks in those situations.
But now, Jeremy, to go back to Dennis's point, don't we have to have some, you know, better use of our assets? Okay, and let's say we agree with you. Let's say that we do need some shelter capacity. Do you disagree that some of the shelter capacity could be better used than money for something else?
Well, there's a reason that as HUD set up its system of running its homeless programs, it's set up as something called a continuum of care. So we need a continuum of assistance for people. In a lot of cases, people can go into permanent housing. We should be finding them permanent housing. In some cases, we need emergency shelter capacity to address very short-term needs, and we should have that capacity to address those short-term needs. What we need to avoid is having people languishing in shelters for long periods of time solely because we're not doing what we should be doing to get them into permanent housing.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that. Dennis, I think that the question I would have for you is this. You know, whatever the Obama administration is offering right now, it's still a drop in the bucket. We might need $500 billion or more to build enough housing to ease the pressure on the housing market or to refurbish it. Well, could it be argued that, you know, your approach of shifting funds, even if it is a more efficient use, you know, in a way obscures the issue that right now we just are having a massive shortfall in terms of what we really need?
I don't think it's obscuring the issue. I think that we have known for a long time, and we continue to know each year the statistics are available, which shows the extent of the housing affordability crisis in this country, which, you know, now 12 to 15 million households are both severely low income and paying more than half of their income on rent. We know what the housing problem is, and in that regard, the emergency assistance in the shelter system is the drop in the bucket, as you said. There's simply no way that one could feasibly argue that the emergency assistance system is going to solve that problem.
But couldn't one also argue, Dennis, that the current rate at which we are trying to do permanent housing is also a drop in the bucket, totally inadequate, ridiculous to even think they're anywhere near to solving the problem? And don't we need to just say it right out? There's not enough money being spent right now to house everybody.
Well, there's no question that we do not have an affordable housing strategy in this country.
Right.
You know, the stimulus plan, all the attention focused on foreclosures, what's very disappointing to me about all those debates is none of those things have focused on the dilemma that faces low-income renters, we crossed the Rubicon in the late 70s, and now we're almost 30 years into this, net deficit of affordable housing units. And, none of these proposals are addressing that. So that most certainly has to be taken on its own merits. What happens in the emergency system is quite a separate matter, however, because I liken it as analogously to, you know, the public health problem. You know, yes, we have a public health problem, which is very large, which has to do with, you know, people exercising and eating well and, having a good standard of living and all these things. But the healthcare system is a separate thing. You know, we have primary care and emergency rooms and hospitals. What we've got going on in the homeless system is we're forcing everyone into the emergency room, everyone into the hospital, because we have no primary care system to assist them. And that is, with regard to the emergency assistance resources that we have in this country and that we should be devoting in this country, they should be focused on solving people's immediate short-term housing problems. It's interesting that Jeremy noted that we shouldn't let people languish in shelters, but in fact, research we've shown, even among families, shows that half of the dollars that are being spent in shelter are being spent to provide shelter that is in excess of 9 months of people in the shelter system. Okay. If instead we spent resources getting those people... We're not talking about a family that is running from abuse and has nowhere to go tomorrow. We're talking about half the beds are filled with people who were there for many, many, many months and who should not be there many months.
Okay, Dennis, let me toss it back to Jeremy.
Then we would have a different system.
Let me toss it back to Jeremy, and then we're going to take some calls. Jeremy, what should we be doing as an overall strategy? Certainly, No one is going to argue with making an efficient use of resources that we've got. But what should be the strategy for housing the American people?
Well, look, I think we have to remember that the strategy for housing the American people is very simple. It's spending money on providing affordable housing for people who need it. The question is, you know, whenever we talk about housing in this country, and as Dennis alluded to, whenever it was discussed in the context of the stimulus, in the context of our current economic problems, it's too often focused almost completely on people who are homeowners. So we have massive tax subsidies through a mortgage interest deduction for homeowners. We have a $75 billion plan to help homeowners in foreclosures that came out last week. But we have no equivalent plan to deal with rental housing. We have this $1.5 billion, which is designed to recognize that people, renters, may lose their homes due to foreclosures and they may need to be rehoused. But that money is just to help them get into other housing. None of that money is intended, nor would it be even close to enough to actually provide new units. Many of us attempted to get money for new Section 8 vouchers in the stimulus package. That didn't happen. We talked about getting funding for the newly created National Housing Trust Fund in the stimulus package. That didn't happen, although I will note that the new administration has indicated that in their budget that comes out this week, they do plan to put a significant amount of money into the National Housing Trust Fund. That would not
Which is a program to build housing.
Yes, that's a program that was created last year that would provide money to states and communities across the country to build new units of affordable housing. Whatever goes into the budget would certainly only be a down payment on a long-term solution. It would not be the solution itself. But I do have to say that I'm pleased at least that our new administration has talked a little more about a rental housing strategy, is starting to demonstrate an early commitment to these issues by providing funding for the trust fund. But we have to go much, much farther. And to do that, we really have to develop a lot more political will, because too often when politicians in Washington think housing, they think homeowners.
Okay. Well, there's a great deal more that can be said, and I hope we'll have a chance to say a great deal more in this hour. But we also want to go to the phones and get other people involved in this discussion. Those numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8. Anybody can call that, or 866-LEFT-OUT if you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless. And also we have a local number if you're listening on WQRZ here in Past Christiane, Mississippi, or in the Environs. It's 463-1035. On the phone, we have Jonathan from Michigan, who has never been homeless. Jonathan, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you, sir. I hope that your fellow across the room from you there, Jeremy Rosen, might be able to shed some light on a few issues that I want to bring to the table.
Okay.
In this discussion.
Okay, name your issues.
All right. I've seen homelessness. It's terrible. The people living under the bridges and stuff like that. But today I'm more interested in Jeremy's point of view as the director of national policy on the relocation of refugees from UN refugee camps in the nation of Nepal. And I've got some friends here who are have been relocated, and they are struggling to find jobs. I wonder what he would say would be the best thing I could do to help them.
Okay, but we're not going to just limit this to people from Nepal. You're talking about people in need who come here and what is for them. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
All right,
yeah.
Well, let me thank you for the call, Jonathan, and I'm going to toss this to Jeremy Rosen and see what he has to say.
Sure. Well, I began my career actually as a legal services attorney in Miami, Florida, dealing with working with folks who are homeless on the streets and the shelters of Miami, where there's a significant immigrant population. And it's an extremely difficult problem that you bring up, because, of course, you know, with folks who are U.S. citizens or legal residents who are homeless, there are a lot of benefits and things available to them, up to and including, in some cases, housing assistance, which may not be available to folks who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents. Sometimes folks who are refugees, if they actually have true refugee status and are not just people who came and overstayed a visa and are simply applying for refugee status, may qualify for some of those benefits. But it's an extremely difficult problem, one that is not overall well addressed by the homeless system. But there's no question a lot of those families do fall into homelessness. And I believe that they probably represent a fairly decent percentage in places where they're living of folks who do languish in emergency shelter because there are no really wonderful long-term housing solutions for them.
Well, this just goes to show, too, I mean, there's just a lot of facets to this issue. That's just one more thing that you wouldn't even think about. Let's take another call. Those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8, 866-LEFT-OUT. Sophia from Steuben, Maine, who you're afraid you're going to be homeless in a day or two. Sophia, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Of course. Tell us your situation, Sophia. We're sorry to hear you're in such distress.
Well, we've had some awful bad weather up here in Maine. I live about a quarter of a mile from the coast as the crow flies. And a lot of these storms that have been coming up have been coastal. And we've had very, very heavy snow. This was our sixth blizzard this year. And the power is out in a lot of places. And my friends and family, unfortunately, all live in the Philly area where I was from. My sister and I own a house over 100 years old. It's a farmhouse. And I have been on a disability pension since 94. I was a former police officer. Unfortunately, what's happened is I haven't, during the past government administration of 8 years, I haven't had the money to put into getting, you know, keeping my house up. And my furnace has been condemned for 3 years now, and I've got boiler seal in it. And we're out of power, and it's looking like we're going to be out of power for 2 or 3 days. And with no backup heat, and I have open pipes in the bathroom where I've been working, you know, in that area trying to fix things up, it looks like I'm going to lose all my pipes. I'm going to lose my furnace, which means I'm going to lose my home and my investment. So, and I have 16 rescued animals.
Wow.
So, you know, that's been kind of my thing that I've tried to do is rescue some homeless pets in our area and have them spayed and neutered. So it's a tough situation. I'm fortunate that a relative did phone in a credit card to let us get a kerosene heater, and I'm currently, as I talk to you, trying to put it together. I don't think, because you know how farmhouses are so cut up, it's not going to reach all the rooms.
Well, you may be in a kind of survival situation. I understand that, and I think you had 16 inches of snow up there. So, first of all, we all sympathize with your situation. Let me toss this
to
Dennis.
We've got 4 feet on the ground.
Wow. Dennis, let me toss this to Dennis. Stay on the line. But, Dennis, let me ask you this.
Sure.
If you rule the world, Dennis, which we all know is not happening, what should the society have available for someone in Sophia's situation?
Well, you know, in all these cases where there's, let's say, first, emergency situations created by natural disasters and others, then FEMA should be providing people with essentially a public form of insurance similar to that which private homeowners would have, you know, if they were displaced because of a fire or other things. And essentially, you know, the Red Cross puts you up for a few days, but then the expectation is that you have, some flexible resources that would enable you to attempt to find temporary housing and to relocate until you're able to restore something. Now, if someone has a situation like your caller where they're in an existing home, and our program, our insurance program, should be to essentially help make them whole, to address the utility issues in terms of the inability to pay back heat payments or what have you. There are a variety of mechanisms that we should have available to people to help them to retain their homes and not end up coming into the homeless system, because the homeless system really doesn't have anything to offer these folks.
Right. I think everybody agrees all over the world that it's cheaper to keep someone in their home than to get them back in after they've lost it.
Well, I don't think everyone agrees with that.
Really?
I don't think everyone agrees with that. No, because, I think that there are some people who think that, if you just left people fend for themselves and don't help them, that a small number of them will end up coming in the homeless system, and that's cheaper than having to provide a sufficient safety net for everyone.
All right, well, you make a good point. That's kind of inhumane, I must say. Jeremy, you wanted to say something?
Well, I would just add the following. I mean, I think the first part of the initial part of what Dennis just described is called emergency shelter, and it shows why we need to retain that capacity.
All right. Sophia, what would you like to say?
Well, what I would like to say is that in my situation, I'm not really able to leave because of the animals, and I'm not really willing to leave. But what I told one person that I spoke to from the many charities I called today and other people was that if I had the money, what I would do is I would start, a program to help people in my situation by buying up a bunch of generators. And see, this is what I need personally, because I have a spinal cord condition that's ultimately it will be fatal. But right now, what's happening is that I'm not able to kind of control my body temperature. So I'm real hypothermia prone. And, it would be, godsend to have, some nice white knight ride in with a generator, hook it up, heat my house up, get the heat up to par, get my pipes running. And there's so many people in my situation here in Maine that really don't have, anyone. And one of the things that we run into is prejudice against people that are not born here. So, like the fire department and people like that, they won't help us. They'll go and take their one generator to somebody that, was born here and who's family's been born here since 1609 or whatever, and they won't they don't really certainly don't expend the the resources to help people like myself. And during the ice storm of 98, when my furnace was in much better condition and I was in a little bit better shape, we went for a week and a half without power, and it was very, very cold. And ultimately, the National Guard came in, and I just happened to get somebody on the phone that was the head of the whole thing. He just come down from Washington, D.C., and he was head of, everything. And I spoke to him, and he said, "Well, why aren't you in your local shelter?" And I said, "Well, we don't have a local shelter." And he says, "You don't have a building big enough for shelter?" I said, "Well, no." I said, "The Beano Hall has power on the main road, but they're using it to play Beano." Mm. And he was if you don't know, that's New Englandese for bingo. And, he just was incensed. And I told some of my relatives, I said, "Look," I said, "this old boy system is still in place in parts of Maine, especially in Washington County, which is one of the further up counties. And you know, we have the old boy judge, and we have the old boy guys in the, you know, the town office and everything. And, you know, it was kind of funny because they came to the house, you know, one after the other, after the National Guard had put a generator and started everything up. You know, I said, boy, I'm going to need an industrial strength tube of chapstick for my rear end because they've been all coming kissing it all day long, you know.
I don't know if we want to really go there, but Sophia?
Yes.
Well, I think we got your drift, and I wish you luck assembling that kerosene heater, and I just want to say on, you know, all of us, many people, anyone who works in this field has heard a lot of stories, not identical to yours, but similar. People were just, you know, caught in what they're caught in, and we just all want to wish you...
Well, you know what? I will say this. My heart goes out, and my prayers and the prayers of my family go out to those who suffered through Hurricane Katrina, because whatever I'm going through now is nothing compared to what they have suffered through.
I'm sure their prayers are for you as well, and I want to thank you very much for the call, Sophia, and we all are going to wish you well.
You're so welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Again, those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8, 866-LEFT-OUT. And at the microphone, we have, sir.
My name is Scott Shearer. And, Jeremy, I'd like to thank you and everybody else for being here. And I'd like to give thanks to Bryce and 103.5 and Katrina Relief for helping us, because there is a lot of homeless. You know, I was one of the founders of Mississippi's Forgotten with Dr. Elizabeth Gallup and the free clinics, you know. We got shut down because we were taking the money from the people, I guess. And I lived in a tent for a year and a half after that. And thanks to Gene Taylor and Miss Kathy, I was able to get a FEMA trailer.
That's Congressman Gene Taylor.
Yes, yes. Well, FEMA took that too. Gave me rental assistance for 2 months.
So where are you now?
Right now I'm in a van on my friend who was just up here, Mr. Philip Stepp. I'm on his property.
Okay, so you are not housed. You are living out of a van right now.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
And where were you before Katrina?
I was right on Main Street, right down in Bay St. Louis, in a beautiful historic home as a renter.
Now, for anybody who doesn't know, there's Waveland, then there's Bay St. Louis, and then there's Pass Christiane, which is where we are today.
That's right.
And those were the three hardest hit communities, right? Like ducks in a row.
Exactly.
Basically. And your former home no longer exists, I think.
No, it doesn't.
Okay, this is story we're going to be hearing a lot, and we've already heard a lot.
Well, you know, it's going to take us. It's going to take people like you and the people that are here. It's going to take our neighbors, not just our next door neighbors, but our neighbors in the next state, and the ones that are going to stand up and say, hey, you know, these people had their homes. These people were renters.
Mm-hmm. And what help was available for you when the storm hit?
You know what? There was no help for a year and a half except for the MREs and the water and food stamps.
Okay, MREs are meals ready to eat. There were military rations handed out and water.
Exactly.
But it wasn't like after the storm there were immediately people who came and said, look, we're going to help you get back into house.
No, there wasn't. It was a year and a half before I got any help. It took my diabetes getting out of control. It took me getting very sick. And it took Gene Taylor to step up and say, hey, this man lived here. This man was a renter. He paid taxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but if you did not have, you know, one of the things that I personally don't like to see, I don't want us turning into a kind of monarchy where you got to reach the nobility before you can get any help. But you got help from Gene Taylor. We're all grateful for that. But basically, there was not, there just wasn't help being passed around here.
There was no assistance.
Okay.
No.
Hang on a second. Dennis, in your... I mean, Dennis, is there any realistic hope that you can see that this country is ever going to have enough help for people in this kind of situation?
Well, I do think that there's opportunities. I think that the current economic crisis is creating an opportunity for us to rethink a whole range of social policies. And I hope that our response to emergency, you know, situations like Katrina is one of them. So hopefully, you know, I'm not hopeless about that situation. I think that there are a lot of opportunities for people to, in Washington, to rethink how we deliver emergency assistance to people, what we do in the face of disasters, and And, of course, the chronic disaster of the lack of affordable housing is one of them.
Jeremy, you are, I guess, a kind of a lobbyist, really. You're an advocate, but, I mean, you actually stalk the halls of Congress. Is that correct? Okay, I'm not hearing your mic there, but go ahead and speak into it. Yeah. What do you think are the chances that we're ever going to see enough money out there for post-disaster, for housing? I mean, we've got a massive problem right now. What's it going to cost to fix?
Well, I'm reluctant to actually put a number on it, but I will say this. I think what we've heard from a lot of from our last caller and from the gentleman who's speaking here at the mic right now is that, you know, what our systems do not do well right now is respond to the unique circumstances that individuals who are homeless, families who are homeless, people who are victims of disasters are facing. We tend to set up and have very rigid and bureaucratic systems which say we can provide you with exactly this sort of help if you're in exactly this sort of situation. Unfortunately, for most people who become homeless and for most folks who are suffering in the wake of disasters, their situations do not fit neatly into the little boxes that we have labeled our different programs as and that we have set up programs to deal with. So one thing that my organization has always advocated in the context of providing communities with money for housing and homeless assistance, but also disaster assistance, is to really be sure that we're providing flexible assistance so that we can really meet the individual needs of people who are without housing.
Well, let's put a number on it. Would $1 trillion be too little or too much if we're going to have a system where everybody is housed and we can respond to emergencies?
Well, I think we just, you know, we just have spent over the past few months more than $1 trillion in Washington, D.C. on other things. My guess would be that $1 trillion would not be enough in this case, but it would certainly be a very significant down payment on getting it done.
I'd sure like it in my pants pocket. Dennis, what would you say? $1 trillion, too much or too little?
Well, I think that way overstates the case. I think that, you know, from what I understand, the best estimates in terms of solving the affordability problem are somewhere in the range of $30 billion. If you wanted to provide, you know, every household that was eligible for housing assistance, federal housing assistance, to get it, it would cost something closer to $30 billion. I don't know the exact number. And then I think the issue of emergencies, that all depends on the scale of the emergency.
Well, of course.
So, you know, that has to be sized accordingly. But it sounds to me like $1 trillion is way overshooting it.
Well, I must say your estimate of $30 billion is way lower than any other estimate I've ever heard in terms of housing everybody. I mean, if you're talking about...
Well, I think if you go to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, who are the folks who are probably best known to be tracking this, you would be surprised then to perhaps find that it's about that amount that is what would be required to provide federal housing subsidies to everybody who was eligible for them. And, of course, this isn't solving every housing problem in America, but the problem we're focusing on here, which is homelessness, which is primarily a problem facing renters who have affordability problems, that's essentially the issue we're talking about.
Well, I think the issue is broader than that, but go ahead, Jeremy.
Well, yeah, I mean, that $30 billion is slightly less than 1 year's worth of the annual HUD budget. And while, you know, that money might provide housing assistance for a number of people, that really, I think, would be a wholly inadequate amount in terms of taking care of our housing construction needs, taking care of our needs for addressing people who are homeless. You know, we can quibble over amounts, but $30 billion is not enough.
There's a scale difference between $30 billion and $1 trillion.
We all will agree on that.
So I think that, and the other fact of the matter here is that all of this, of course, occurs in the context of a political conversation, and we have to understand where the political will is, and what are the proportionate demands and expected responses we can get. I mean, we can all. It's very easy to sit back and say, oh, we just should give every dollar we have to all of these issues, but, you know, that's completely unrealistic.
Dennis, I have to say...
It's easy to be right, okay?
Right.
But it's a lot harder to win something and to gain, you know, practical victories for the people we're talking about.
Well, Dennis, wouldn't it have been more... Dennis.
If we start saying $1 trillion to solve the affordable housing problem, then guess what? That's a non-starter. That conversation is going nowhere.
You know, we
so
can talk
it's
about
very important to put this into the context of what we understand to be statistically the reasonable approaches that have to be undertaken.
Dennis, I will say this. You know, if we're going to start talking realism here, I mean, was it realistic to spend $1 trillion on a war in Iraq for weapons of mass destruction that don't exist? I don't know. Well, personally,
obviously it was. It happened.
Right, but I don't think realism should not just be confined to the poor. But we all will agree. Let's spend the $30 billion and see where we are. No one's going to disagree with that.
I would point out this, though. I mean, we spend about $150 billion a year on our mortgage interest tax deduction for homeowners.
All right.
If we did something that I do think is actually politically sellable, which is limit that deduction so that lower income folks are taking it, but folks who own $1 million homes are not taking it, we'd have
money.
The $30 billion right there by next year.
You know,
Wait. I want to take some more. We got people with the mic. Sir, at the mic. Sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Scott,
do you have a last comment to make? Because I got people I want to get in on this discussion. It's an interesting discussion, but I got a lot of people. I don't want them just stacked up on the phone.
Okay,
so.
Let's just help our neighbors. Let's help each other. It's going to take us. It's our economy. We're the ones that put the money in. Let's help each other.
So you're saying we have to change our priorities.
You know what? We got a beach walk going up. We got people losing their houses and people having to move. Which is more important, the economy or a place to walk?
Thank you very much, Scott, for sharing with us. Those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 and 866-LEFT-OUT. I have Chris in Sapphire, North Carolina. Chris, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hello.
Hi. Well, you've been listening to this discussion. What would you like to add? You're out of work and you'll be homeless soon, I understand.
Yes, sir. And what I want to confront is the emotional side of what people have to deal with along.
Go ahead.
Okay, it takes away from, you know, feeling about yourself, feeling the pride that you have as far as working, the energy, you know, just being a person that is being productive.
All right, I think everybody will agree. It's depressing to be out of work. It takes away from your self-esteem. Are you saying you think there should be job programs for people? What are you saying should be out there? And we, of course, wish you well in terms of getting employment again.
Well, I'm thinking that there should be an emotional level of, I agree with you on that, some kind of way that a job, like where they produce jobs, well, not producing jobs, but just the psychological part.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. And you are facing homelessness simply because of a loss of income. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
And where are you living now, Eric? I mean, Chris.
I live in the mountains in Sapphire, North Carolina.
But you have an apartment are you in?
I live in a house. I rent. I have worked very hard all my life. I've always been independent. Very talented as far as, you know, just being able to produce, you know, do any kind of work there is, but workforce is not available.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And can I ask you what your rent is?
My rent is around $750 a month.
So you're not living in a mansion. You're living in a modest place of some sort.
Yes, sir.
And you just can't make it right now.
Is correct.
Are you on unemployment?
No, I do receive food stamps because I had no choice on that. And I never asked for any kind of help in my entire life.
How old are you?
Excuse me?
How old are you now?
41.
So this is the first time you've been in this situation, you're saying?
Exactly correct.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to flesh that out a little so people understand. You're someone who's been in the workforce. You're not leading an extravagant lifestyle, but the loss of your income could immediately result in the loss of housing.
That is correct. And I'm close to losing the house that I'm in at the present moment as far as rent, and that's, you know.
Okay. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for calling. We all want to wish you well. I hope you get employment. It's a tough climate out there, and we certainly hope you won't be out of your housing, and good luck to you. Those numbers to call in again are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. We have Eric in Bend, Oregon, wants to get in.
I just wanted to flesh that out.
Yes.
Well, we're getting some kind of weird feedback. Okay, Eric in Bend, Oregon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Eric. Well, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. Thank you for joining this discussion. What's on your mind? What would you like people to know?
Just that the way the economy is going. I am currently staying at the Bethlehem Inn here in Bend, Oregon, and it's been a very, very good program for the homeless people that are here in Bend.
And you're in a shelter, in other words?
Yes, I am.
And what function, because we've been having a discussion here about shelters, what function has the shelter played in your life? Are you there for a long time? Are you there for a little time? What is it for you?
I've been here for a couple months. It's actually been probably one of the best things that's ever happened to me, homeless-wise.
And why is that?
Just the way that the staff helps you out. Everybody helps you with transitions and getting everything going with trying to help you get a place and things like that.
Can you turn your radio down, please? And I'll come right back to you, but it's creating some feedback there.
Okay, hang on.
All right. And, well, I mean, while he's doing that, Jeremy, let me ask you a question. I mean, would we all agree, because I know Dennis and you have been talking, I brought up the trillion-dollar figure, but we would agree, wouldn't we, with Dennis at least, that let's make a start and spend the $30
billion? Well, sure. Who wouldn't take $30 billion to spend on housing and homeless assistance? At this time or any time. The question, of course, is how would we spend that money? And I think we'd, of course, want to put a significant amount into building new units of affordable housing. We'd want to put a significant amount into housing subsidies for people in situations where there is available housing, but they can't afford it. And we'd want to put a significant amount of money into helping folks who are in the situation of our last caller, which we're hearing day after day after day from people across the country in this economy who are, you know, one missed paycheck away from potentially becoming homeless and who may need short-term rent assistance to get back on their feet.
Yeah, I've never gone for that one paycheck statistic. What if it's two or three? It's still a problem. Doesn't have to be one. But in any case, Eric, would you get back to you? Have you been homeless before this stint in the shelter?
No, this is my first time.
So you're not what they would call, quote-unquote, chronically homeless. You're somebody who ran into some difficulty and you became homeless, and the shelter was your last resort.
Yes, I had one other option to go somewhere else, but that didn't work out. So I basically had nowhere to go, and I had nothing to do. So I came here.
And what are your prospects for getting out of homelessness?
Just trying to find a job right now, which here in Bend, Oregon is very, very limited. Just trying to get back on my feet, trying to get a place to live and a stable job.
Are you in a shelter where they kick you out in the morning and then you can have to wait to get back in at night?
We have to leave at 8:30 every morning, and we can come back on site at 4:30, but during the day I work on site, so I am able to be here.
I see. Well, that's actually better than a lot of shelters. Some of them will throw you out at like 6, and you can't get in until like later than that. So,
No. And if the weather's bad, we can stay. So
it's not a bad shelter, then, as shelters go.
Oh, right? No. It's probably one of the best I've seen.
Okay. And you've seen other shelters, then?
I've seen the Eugene one also. I've been through there, but I haven't stayed there. But the Bethlehem Inn is probably the best one I've seen.
Right. And that's partly because it's a small town, I take it.
Yeah, Bend, Oregon is not that big.
And how many people are in the shelter with you?
Right now we have 60, I believe.
And would you say, as you look around at your fellow residents of that shelter, because the people out there in America want to understand this, would you say, what percentage of them, give me a percentage, what percentage would you say are really struggling to get back on their feet, and what percentage would you say are just not really trying?
The percent that I would say, probably about, 20-30% are really trying. And then the ones that I see, by the way I see it, is probably about 10% are not trying. The ones that are just trying to stay here for free, pretty much.
Well, that only adds up to about 30%. What about the rest of them?
The same.
So you're saying most of the people you think are not really trying very hard?
Most of the people are. It's just actually more of a smaller amount aren't.
Okay, So you'd say to people, whatever it is, just you're saying you think most of the people are trying and some people are kind of freeloading. It's not that there's no freeloaders, but they're not typical.
Yeah, most everybody is trying. It's just one little small amount that is.
All right. Well, Eric...
Actually, Jeremy, I object to the term freeloaders.
All right.
Just because I think it's overly pejorative.
Okay, I'll accept that correction.
There are people who, despite their best efforts, are not able to get out of the shelter system, and we know that. It's a well-known fact. And many of these people have disabilities. They are not going to be able to get out of homelessness without some kind of permanent subsidy, without some support services.
I was trying to speak in the perceptual thing, but yes, I thank you for pointing that out. Many people who appear that they're not trying really have particular difficulties. You're absolutely right. I certainly didn't mean to imply otherwise, but I just meant in terms of how Eric's, would talk in the common perception. That, some people are trying harder than others, and I'm sure that that's true. Eric, I want to thank you very much for the call. Dennis, I want to ask you this quickly. We're running out of time. One problem I have with what you're saying that I don't understand, as I understand it, the HUD budget used to be $65 billion. Now it's like $28 billion. I don't know the latest figure. So we used to be spending $30 billion more a year on housing.
I don't believe that's true.
Okay. So what do you think the figures are?
I am not aware that that there was a 50% cut in HUD funding. Certainly, there was no growth. In fact, negative growth in the Bush years. Things stayed close with inflation for the Clinton years, and the Reagan years are a little difficult to account because there was a shift from doing public housing and building new public housing and moving more towards vouchers.
Right, we're almost out of time. I'm talking back from the Ford administration peak, which I think was around $65 billion. Sheila Crowley of the NLIHC, National Low Income Housing Coalition, is the one who actually gave me these figures, and I know you had cited their figures before.
Yeah. Well, then, obviously Sheila knows what she's talking about more than I do.
I respect your opinion, too.
My business is not tracking federal expenditures. But, I don't think anyone disagrees that there isn't a need for, more federal spending on housing.
No, I think there's actually more agreement here than disagreement. I think, we'll all take the $30 billion, and if we ever got our hands on the trillion and it turned out to be too much, we'll find something else to do with it. Jeremy, what's your understanding about the federal budget on this?
Well, I think if you look at real dollars, there has effectively been close to a 50% cut over the past 30 years. We were building literally hundreds of thousands of units of affordable housing a year during the 1970s, and we're building hardly any right now. It's down to something like 20 or 30,000 a year.
Well, that's where I say I think you have to adjust for the differences in amortized costs and dollars that go into new construction versus, and that was what happened in the 80s, is there was a dramatic shift towards subsidy as opposed to construction.
Let me just say to the people holding on the phone and at the mic that we're running out of time for this hour, so if you will just hang on, we're going to take a break, not this second, and when we come back, we're going to try and get you all. But let's sum up. Jeremy, what would you like the people in America to know about what we ought to be doing about housing and how we ought to be solving this problem in 10, 20 seconds?
Well, I'll just say the following. I think we had a good discussion of how to do things nationwide, but let's make sure we start to pilot some of those solutions down here on the Gulf Coast. We spent this whole hour talking about housing and homelessness, but really didn't touch on Gulf Coast issues that much. So let me just say, let's make sure we focus on rebuilding our communities down here.
Okay, I gotta stop there. And yes, of course, we should here. Dennis, you got about 15 seconds at most. What can you tell us? What should we know about how to help the homeless and in the Gulf Coast as well?
Well, I think we need to put most of our resources into helping people get back into housing. I think that we had 20 years of expanding the size of the emergency shelter system, and we have more homelessness as a result.
We're out of time. I want to thank you both very much for participating in the...
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with Community Radio WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.